Time now for hour number two of this weekend's big two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and Carol Marks, our host, is ready to go. Here she is now in conversation with Kelly Turner, Ph.D. Kelly Turner is a researcher, lecturer, and counselor in integrative oncology. And she's going to talk to Carol about a new book titled Radical Remission, Surviving Cancer Against All Odds. It's published by Harper One.
What is the difference between radical remission and what it's often been called spontaneous remission from cancer?
There is no difference. I just don't like the word spontaneous because, like I said, I'm one of the only people who's really researched this topic. And doctors 100 years ago just called it spontaneous remission because they couldn't explain why this cancer was going away. But if you look at the word spontaneous, it means that something happened by chance or by luck, or it just happened on its own. Well, when I actually started researching this phenomenon and talking to these people, I figured out that they worked very hard to go into remission, often over a course of years. And so the word spontaneous doesn't really describe the majority of these people, and actually many of them take a lot of offense to that word. They said, this wasn't spontaneous, I worked my tail off. So I've come up with this other term, radical remission, because they made radical changes in their lives to have these radical results.
So very good explanation.
It's a better way to describe it. And actually, while we're talking about it, I should probably define what we're talking about. So spontaneous or radical remission is when cancer goes away without conventional medicine. That's either from the beginning, so someone might choose not to use conventional medicine because of their own beliefs, or what's more frequent is people try conventional medicine to its fullest, but it just isn't working, and then they have to try other things, and then they can get, then a few of those people do turn it around. Those are the people that I study.
Now, I want to ask you before we continue how you feel about the conventional cancer treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation.
I believe in them fully and wholeheartedly. I'm so glad you asked that, Carol. I'm always quick to say that I am in no way against Western medicine. I'm a big believer in it. It's just that there's this control group. There's this unique group of people out there who are healing without it, and no one's looking at them. And we have a lot to learn as scientists from studying the anomalies that are in our world. So some of science's greatest discoveries have come from looking at things that don't behave the way we think they should. And so that's why I'm looking at these cases, because they're really strange. They're not behaving the way we would expect them to. And therefore, as a scientist, they are worth studying simply because of that fact. But just because I study these people doesn't mean that I think we should all go instantly copycat what they're doing. I think instead what we should do is study them and learn from them.
Excellent. You did a lot of research to document the cases of people who recovered from cancer against all odds. So how long did it take you to do the research? How many people did you interview? Countries you visited? Were there a lot of them? And what about the holistic healers? How many people did you talk to?
Absolutely. Well, I've been studying radical remission now for more than 10 years, and I've analyzed over 1,000 of these cases. I've done over 200 direct interviews, like in-depth interviews with radical remission survivors. And then, of course, I've analyzed other cases that have been published. During that 10 years, I did take a year of my dissertation research time to travel around the world to 10 different countries. And that was not only to find radical remission survivors, which I did, which was fantastic, but also to find and interview alternative cancer healers from around the world. Because many of the people that I was studying, I quickly found out that they were literally traveling to the ends of the earth to try to get well and finding doctors and healers in other countries who were willing to do something else besides just hospice, which many of the people I studied, you know, that was what they were, that was their only choice because they had tried everything else. And so I did travel to 10 different countries to find survivors and healers who were treating cancer in unique ways. In terms of the healers, I've interviewed now over 75 of them directly.
Now, I understand that most of your case studies revolved around people with stage 4 cancers who either declined conventional treatment or were given treatment that didn't work. But didn't the Radical Remission Project didn't that also involve people that didn't have cancer that had other serious problems?
Well, we haven't, the Radical Remission Project, which is at radicalremission.com, is my ongoing research. And we are in the process of opening that up to other radical remissions from other illnesses, such as HIV/AIDS or chronic conditions. Anyone who's had sort of a miraculous turnaround or recovery, we are about to open it up to collect cases from other illnesses. We haven't set that up quite yet on the website, but it's certainly where my research is going.
Now, how common is radical remission, and do you think it's vastly underreported?
It is. I'll answer your second question first, because it is vastly underreported, which makes it very hard for me to answer your first question, which is how often does it happen? These cases are not tracked in the National Cancer Registry, which is how all of our cancer statistics are created from this National Cancer Registry. So we really don't know how often these cases are happening. They're not reported by their doctors. Right now, in the medical journals, it's estimated that one out of every 60,000 cancer cases is a radical remission. I think it's actually much higher. Again, I'm one of the only people who's been studying this, and I've been doing that for 10 years. In my estimation, for every case that's published, I think that there are 100 more that go unpublished. And just to prove that fact, in my research, I have always looked first for unpublished cases, because I can always go back to those 1,000 that are published and track those people down and interview them. And I have not had any trouble finding unpublished cases. All of the cases that I've studied in the past 10 years are in the direct interviews are unpublished cases. So it just shows you that these cases really aren't being reported or tracked anywhere.
Well, I think one of the most groundbreaking things that you did in your interviews with patients that experienced radical remission was to ask them something that no one had ever asked before. What did they do to get well? And you came up with 9 of the most common factors that they thought helped them, and how many of them were physical and how many of them were emotional?
Right. Well, I think it's important to say that in my interviews, there were over 75 different factors that came up of why these people believe they healed. But when I actually tabulated the frequency of how often these factors were happening across all of my cases, there were 9 that almost every person did. So that's why there are a top 9, or the 9 key healing factors. And of those 9, only 2 were physical. And that was really surprising to me. Now, maybe it's not surprising to other people, because physically they had done almost as much as they could, you know, in terms of what their doctors had offered them. So they're at a point where they need to try other things. And if they've tried physical things to their limit, maybe it does make sense then that they try more emotional and spiritual things. But yes, only 2 of the 9 key factors in my book and my research are physical, and that's changing your diet radically and also taking herbs and supplements.
And I always knew that there needed to be a strong and integrated mind-body connection that we have if we want to be healthy. But I was totally blown away by the study with patients who had cancer and had never meditated. So when it came to their cancers, what were the results of 6 weeks of meditation? Because I thought they were amazing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful new study that came out. Very recent, so it hasn't quite trickled down to the general public. So I'm happy to have featured it in my book, because what this groundbreaking study showed us on meditators is it was looking at their genes. So many of us think that our genes are our destiny, right? What we inherit, we are stuck with. And actually, science for the past 30 years has learned that that's not quite true. There's a field of scientific research called epigenetics, which means beyond the genes. And that is looking at what factors in our behavior impact which genes are turned on or turned off. So, yes, you can inherit a bad gene from your parents. You can inherit a flawed gene from your parents. But it's only going to cause problems for you if it is turned on, like a light switch. So if it is expressed or turned on, it will cause you problems. If it's turned off, you'll have it in your DNA, but it won't cause you any trouble. And what this meditation study showed was they took people who had never meditated before. These were beginners. They taught them how to meditate, and they looked at their genetic expression, so which genes were turned on and turned off, before and after the 6 weeks of instruction. And amazingly, only after 6 weeks these beginner meditators were able to turn off cancer genes and turn on health-promoting genes. So we have a lot more control over our genes and over our health than we ever believed possible before. And a lot of that control can come from what we do with our habitual thoughts and feelings. Because our thoughts and feelings actually instantly send a chemical flood into our bloodstream as soon as we have that thought or feeling. So if we have chronic stress, we're sending cortisol and adrenaline and other immune-suppressing chemicals into our bloodstream. Whereas if we're meditating and getting into a state of deep breathing and peace and non-stress, then we're sending a whole host of other healing hormones into our bloodstream, which actually boosts the immune system. So it's very connected and very...
And would you say, Dr. Turner, that the mind leads the body when it comes to healing? It's not the other way around.
Well, I wouldn't say that because I'm just a researcher, and I'm always quick to say that I'm not a medical doctor, and I'm not here to prescribe anything or give advice. But I will say that everyone that I've studied, all the radical remission survivors, have said that. They do say that. They say the mind leads the body. And that's their opinion, but that is the belief that has helped them, in their opinion, get well. So I think it is something worth listening to and learning from and studying further, this idea that the mind does sort of tell the body chemically what to do. Now, we know that that's true from a scientific standpoint. We know that when you have thoughts and emotions, chemicals are instantly released. There are some cases where the body can tell the mind what to do, right? So when the body's hungry, it makes you think, oh, I need to go find food. So there is sort of a two-way street here, but I think medicine hasn't focused on that first point, which is that, you know, the mind really sends very clear signals to every cell in your body.
That's Kelly Turner, Dr. Kelly Turner. She's a PhD, and her book is titled Radical Remission, Surviving Cancer Against All Odds, published by Harper One. If you want more information, go to radicalremission.com. The interview was conducted by Carol Marks. And Carol Marks returns with another interesting conversation. She'll be talking about lupus. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is our host, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Sandra Raymond. She's president and CEO of the Lupus Foundation of America, and she's going to talk to Carol about a new unveiled survey that showed how this disease continues to take a toll on people with lupus and lupus caregivers.
Can you tell us a little about lupus, because a lot of people are not up to speed or don't know about it?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the people most affected by lupus are young women between the ages of, let's say, 15 and 44, and they are the least aware of lupus. And in all of the studies that we've done to date, we find that that group is the least aware of lupus. But you're asking me, what is lupus? And it is a chronic autoimmune disease that can affect any part of the body, whether it's the kidney or the brain or the blood system or the skin. It can affect any one of those organ systems. And, you know, the thing about lupus that makes it so much a cruel mystery is that the symptoms come and go, and they change over time, and they look like another disease, and they're very difficult to diagnose. And that is what the Unveil survey that we're pardon the expression, unveiling today, is telling us that, number one, that individuals with lupus really are diagnosed on average almost 6 years from the time that there is the first symptom that is noticed. So an average of nearly 6 years before you can get
that,
a diagnosis.
You know, that is so devastating.
It's devastating because, you know, the effect on that organ system then, damage is occurring. And so there's no medication being taken, the organ is being damaged, and that damage is irreparable. So that's a very serious thing. The other thing that we found in the UNVEIL study is that the impact shows that it's very challenging to treat. We are treating lupus currently with intravenous chemotherapies, with steroids. These are drugs that have pretty serious side effects. So beyond the symptoms of lupus, we're getting the serious adverse effects of some of the drugs that we're using to treat the disease. So there is a huge need for an arsenal of new treatments. And the third major finding was that lupus interrupts every facet of life, from work life to family life, and to daily living and mental health. And not only does it affect the individual with the disease, but also the family members who have to help this individual navigate through multiple doctors, multiple medications, multiple hospital visits, etc. So life is interrupted both for the caregivers and for the individual with lupus.
And it can be constantly changing as to if, you know, when you do get diagnosed with kinds of things that you have to treat at a particular moment. Now, one of the things that I learned from all the excellent work that the Lupus Foundation has done, and I wasn't aware of that, you know, there always are clinical trials for different diseases, but most of the clinical trial, and again, that's been something that's been difficult to have come out the way you would like them. Why have clinical trials been difficult to get help for new drugs for lupus patients?
Well, the main reason why it's been difficult to do clinical trials in lupus is because lupus affects individuals very differently from person to person. When you have a clinical trial, what you're looking for is a group of people who have like symptoms so that you can test a new drug against a standard of care or a placebo, you know, a sugar pill. And the fact that you have people who are different coming into a clinical trial makes it very difficult for you to get standardized results. So trying to figure out whether the drug, the new drug, works against the old drug is going to be difficult because the people that are in the trial are on all kinds of background medications. So they're not the same. And you want to do a great clinical trial, you want to get people in there that are all the same so that you can really see, measure the differences in a much more efficient way. So our trials are very, very challenging. We have many challenges, and the Lupus Foundation of America is actually trying to solve those challenges. One of our national medical research programs is called Bringing Down the Barriers to Drug Development. And so bringing down the barriers to drug development means finding ways to address the challenges in clinical trials. The other problem is recruitment or education of people about participating in a clinical trial. We want to educate individuals that participating in a clinical trial is really helping your fellow man if, in fact, this is appropriate for you. So we want it to be appropriate. We want to educate about it. We want to let people know what trials are out there.
And one of the things that your organization does that I think it's so great is that the Lupus Foundation of America does support research that will help lupus patients, and that's why we need to have the general public as well as people with lupus supporting it with donations. And I understand that perhaps one of the things that might prove fruitful in the future would be some of the gene research, because if we could have found the genes that cause lupus in some people, perhaps we could alter them.
Well, we've actually found those genes. I mean, we found at least 50 genes that are connected to lupus. But the work to connect those genes to what causes lupus is a problem because the research effort, at least the federal research effort, which, by the way, the two largest supporters of research are the federal government and pharmaceutical companies, not private foundations like ours. Okay, although we do absolutely support research. But the larger money, the hundreds of millions of dollars, come from those two sources. So it's really important that we make sure that NIH, for example, has a robust research enterprise. And right now, funds have been cut to NIH, and that is hurting all of these diseases and all of these clinical trials. The drug companies, however, have been investing in lupus research, and they find it extremely challenging, but they're pioneers, and there are more of them today than ever before.
Now, Sandra, what did the unveiled survey show about the biggest challenges for both people living with lupus and their caregivers, and were their challenges similar, or were they dissimilar in some ways?
Okay, well, what the UNVEIL study found with respect to the caregiver and the individual with lupus that was very, very similar was that over 90% of individuals with lupus and the caregivers felt anxious and depressed. Okay, so that was a similar finding. In addition, another similar finding was the interruption of work. So when you begin to think that this disease, you understand that it affects young women, then you know that the individual that's helping that daughter, let's say, is also a pretty young woman who's in the workforce, and her life is being interrupted as well due to the obligation she has with her daughter, who must either go to a multitude of doctors, who must take tests, who might enter a hospital, who may not be feeling well, and someone has to stay with her, etc. So the impact on the caregiver is as great, I think, as the impact on the patient.
That's Sandra Raymond in conversation with Carol Marks. Sandra Raymond is president and CEO of the Lupus Foundation of America. If you want more information, go to www.lupus.org. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat here at A Touch of Gray. The program continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to the segment of our program where we're joined the rest of the way by our eloquent senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now is going to be speaking with Dr. Jennifer Tagia. She's a geriatrician and a palliative care specialist at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and she's the lead author of a new study that shows nursing home patients with advanced dementia were given what the researchers called medications of questionable benefit. Very interesting. We look forward to that, Richard. I guess it's going to be distressing news, though. You already conducted this interview. The world premiere is in a few minutes. Give us a little trailer of what's coming up.
Well, part of the problem that Dr. Tagia talks about is the fact that there have been studies on the effectiveness of a lot of these things. And a lot of the drugs that are used in early stage dementia that can help slow the progress down, in later stages probably don't do anything. And yet they're constantly being taken, they are expensive, and, you know, we're always trying to rein in healthcare costs. And this is one area where if you're feeding somebody an expensive medication that doesn't do anything, you can make a change.
You know what ultimately the problem is, and this is just me projecting my own theories, theoretical view of this, is that somewhere between cutting costs and avoiding the prescription of drugs that don't work and therapies that don't work is the fine line between withholding drugs and withholding therapy for cost to people that might need it or to some benefit they would get. You know, back to that death panel hyperbole, that it's very hard to know where that line is between what is wasteful and what is, you know, being too frugal.
Well, and the other thing is that doctors don't have the time to invest in actually finding this stuff out. You know, they prescribe, how are you feeling? How's it working? Oh, it's okay. Okay, great. And they leave it alone. And I think our medical system is just so stressed and overwhelmed with all the things that they have to deal with that old individual Marcus Welby, you know, I'll spend as much time with you as you need, just doesn't exist anymore, and we kind of wholesale things. And as you pointed out many times, we go on statistics. We say, well, 60%, it works for 60%, so we'll give it to you because the odds are it'll work for you. Well, what if you're part of the 40 where it doesn't?
Mm-hmm. Or what if you're part of the drug prescription? You know, when drug companies pass the muster with the FDA, it isn't for eternity. They say it is safe for 3 or 4 doses, 3 or 4 prescriptions, 6 months, 1 year. Some people are on drugs for years and years and years, and they have no idea what the long-term effects of them are. I found that out recently, and it blew my mind. But something, just backtracking for a second, I wonder why, and again, this is theory, I'm not Mr. Smarty Pants, so just wonder why the healthcare industry has such a supply and demand problem that it's so stressed to the max, when in fact there is money to be made. Why is the average doctor so overwhelmed, so overworked? Why do they come into the exam room looking at your file and prepping for the conversation while walking in and talking to you and then giving you prescriptions and diagnosis that really do require a Marcus Welby type of consideration? My feeling is, and I guess I'm naive because there has to be an answer, is maybe we just don't have enough doctors. Maybe they should have a new way of creating different classes of doctors so more people can get into that profession and thus it'll balance out. Quick impression.
Well, yeah, because it costs so much to become a doctor in the first place that once you are there, you are stressed to make as much money as you can to pay back your loans and to provide a livelihood and all of that. So I think they overschedule, obviously. They try to get in as many people as they can. They're called upon to be businessmen as well as doctors, and we haven't drawn a nice clear line between the two.
Yeah, I got to talk to you about the dental industry. You and I have actually talked about that, but we don't have time for that now. Talk about promoting and being business people. Sometimes when I go to the dentist these days, I feel like I'm at the car dealer making a deal with me to upgrade to a better car.
Let's do that next segment.
Yeah.
That's a long discussion.
Okay, very good. Okay, Richard is going to be talking with Dr. Jennifer DeGia next, and then he'll be back to talk with us. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, Screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here, as promised, is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Dr. Jennifer Tagia. She's a geriatrician and palliative care specialist at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and lead author of a new study that showed nursing home patients with advanced dementia were given what the researchers called medications of questionable benefit.
You're here to talk about drugs that, you know, we all, as we get older, memory loss, we have various forms of dementia, sometimes real or imagined, and we all look to, well, is there a way to ward this off? Is there a drug we can take? Is there something we can do to help ourselves? And sometimes we're so desperate that we take things that really don't help, do they?
Well, you know, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to join you. I think that what you're doing is really important. And as we're all afraid of getting old, and dementia is a really scary thing for a lot of us, and I think it's in our nature to try and do things to prevent it, to make it go away, or to slow it down. And, you know, thank God that pharmaceuticals have come by to try and address this problem. And I think the real challenge is that often I see that we put a lot more hope in the available medications out there than they really offer.
Can you give us an example of a drug that is widely used that may not be as effective as people think it is?
Well, you know, I think that it's more complicated than is it effective or not effective, and that's the premise of the study that that we just put out in JAMA Internal Medicine. There's a saying in out there, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. And is it time under the sun for this and that? And the point is that for medications to address or treat dementia in this case, they were studied and developed. They were developed and studied in a very specific stage of dementia. And most of the clinical trials that show that these medications are of benefit are in early stages. And in fact, the very early trials that came out were in very early stages, and the endpoint of those trials was placement in a nursing home. And most of these trials didn't last for more than, let's say, 12 weeks. And so what happens is that we do a clinical trial, we do it for 12 weeks, for example, and the endpoint is nursing home placement, and they showed that in people who took the medications, we could delay nursing home placement. And that will, the drug companies, they've done a lot of their investments. This is a benefit. This is an important outcome to patients and to their families. And they say, we're going to go do this. We're going to put our loved ones on it. The trouble is when we start to either use medications outside of where they're studied, outside of where they're approved by the FDA, or they're continued without really taking a look back to see, are we still, what goals are we trying to treat? And the point of the paper that I wrote is that we have not studied, we don't know, and in fact we have a lot of reason to believe that these medications have very little benefit in the most advanced stages of dementia, at the very end of life. We don't do studies in these populations. There are no clinical trials that show that if we continue these drugs and at this very late stage where there's a very high mortality rate, that there's really benefit. And yet, because there were studies in earlier stages of disease, we just keep it going.
Well, who is charged? Would it be the primary physician charged with understanding that at this point this drug is not really accomplishing anything and it's time to just let that particular drug go? Who makes those calls?
Ideally, it should be ongoing exchange between the physician and the family's caregiver and decision makers. But we need to step back and realize that really clinical medicine in this day and age hasn't really gotten to the point where we can, where we're comfortable. Like just as a profession, we're much more comfortable with starting things. We're much less comfortable with the idea of stopping things or not doing things because they have limited benefit. And so it's not really fair to say it's the primary care person who's supposed to do it, because I think we as a profession need to make this decision, and I think we're starting to with campaigns that are called like Choosing Wisely that the American Board of Internal Medicine have put out. And it's only now that we're really starting to realize, not just for these type of diseases or this type of drug, that maybe less is more. Maybe we don't have to do everything that is possibly, that we can possibly do at all times in all circumstances. And so that's a long answer to, I guess it should be the primary care physician, but there are a ton of barriers for that. And we need to, as a profession, take responsibility for that and educate ourselves on how to do that, how to have that conversation, and how to create space in the clinical encounters to make that happen.
And I guess this ties in as well with healthcare costs, and in most cases you're talking Medicare and government subsidies. And, you know, the government, where do they draw the line? What are the guidelines in terms of Medicare, in terms of covering these drugs past their usefulness?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Medicare in general hasn't really addressed the question of if we should cover these drugs when they're past their usefulness. Because, as I sort of alluded to before, the whole idea that medications are being used past their usefulness is still a relatively radical idea for some people to deal with. And there's not enough randomized controlled trial evidence or impetus in the research literature to get it to where Medicare is going to make broad recommendations about payment. That said, in the nursing home setting, which is also heavily regulated by Medicare and Medicaid and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in the specific nursing home setting, there is a regulation, and it's referred to as F329, that says that all nursing home residents are supposed to be free of all unnecessary medications. And they will say that these are unnecessary because they're duplicative, because they're ineffective, because they don't treat what they're supposed to treat, or they're otherwise just unnecessary. And so the intent is there. The issue is that it's been very narrowly defined to drugs that have been shown to be either dangerous or inappropriate. And there has been very little effort or work around this question of if they're just not useful anymore. And that's not at the level of payment, it's just at the level of like intent of what we should do for our nursing home residents.
Doctor, is there a place or a website where the general public can get more information on this?
There are websites about how we can improve nursing home care in general. And I think that the piece that Dr. Sachs wrote in JAMA Internal Medicine about how families and physicians in general should reconsider medications in the very end stages of life is a really useful resource.
That's Dr. Jennifer Tejia in conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we continue our conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. And we were talking off the air during the break about the topic we touched upon earlier, and that is the changing role of dentistry in terms of going from a very elite profession to being a business that's promoted like car dealerships or let us build a pool in your backyard. It's crazy. I go to my dentist now, and I feel like I'm a marketing target. And it's not just one dentist, and I'm talking about everybody's complaining about what's happening to this new school of dentists that are coming out. They're like manic promoters.
Well, I've got a story. I had a bad tooth with a pocket, a gum pocket. For those who've had them, they know what they are. And I was referred to a periodontal specialist, and he looks at it and he goes, well, I don't think we can save this tooth. I think we should pull it, and then I'll do a bone graft, and then I'll do an implant, and, you know, within a year and a half, you'll have a bright, shiny new tooth there. And, of course, the implants are not covered under my plan, and I thought, okay, this is a rear molar. I could probably live without it. So I said, well, you know what, why don't we just take it out? Is there any long-term bad effect if we just remove it? Well, no, you'll have a little gap there. And I said, well, that's what we'd like to do. And he goes, okay, well, I'll refer you to someone. Well, why can't you do it? Well, I don't do just extractions. And I got the feeling is if you don't go for the gold-plated, very expensive implant, we're not interested in taking care of you, but there'll be some peon dentist who will do this for you. And I felt very offended that,
you know, I couldn't have the tooth. And as it turned out, I go to another dentist, and instead of taking it out or doing anything, he puts a filling in it, and it's fine.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Go figure.
Well, go figure. Go figure. It's now a business. It's not a profession. It's no longer a profession. It's a business. And there is a difference between a profession and a business. That's why they used to have the term ambulance chasers. It was considered to be derogatory in the legal profession to be overt in selling your services or chasing business. Now, I got a letter. I have a dentist, and he's a very good dentist. He's a young dentist. He bought the practice of my older dentist, who was an old school dentist, you know, where you went to a professional who cared about your teeth. And the whole place it has a logo now. They've got sign in, what did you think of our service, like us on Facebook. I mean, it's crazy. Guy sends me a birthday card, custom made. Dear Michael, happy birthday. You know, it's one of those computerized things where it's beautiful card, his picture, the staff, the logo, and it says on it, "Thank you for your patronage and support of our practice," which offended the hell out of me. Patronage? Wow. What am I? I'm a patron of you, and I support your practice is supposed to be there to support me. And thank you for any references that you give your friends. Send your friends to us. They are in business. Now, I know it's a business. I'm not stupid, but come on. Have some pride. Well,
Michael, my dogs get business birthday cards from the vet. So it's not just dentists who do this.
The dogs get birthday cards from the vet. And do you know that some fictitious pen names that we have at Talkers and Radio Info, the two trade publications we do, so there are several pen names. The pen names get letters from banks telling them because of their great credit history, they are pre-approved for credit cards. So, oh boy, what a crazy world. Richard, thank you. We got to go. Did you have something to say? Squeeze it in.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm getting letters from my brother who lived with us 20 years ago for a couple of months while he was building a house, and I'm still getting letters at my address for him.
Wonderful. Say yes and charge it to him. Richard Neer, thank you very much. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you so much to Beverly Santinello, our producer on the front line. Thank you, Carol Marks, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for blacks.